This episode of East Meets West is brought to you by Carbonite Online Backup. Backing up the files on your PC or Mac is safe and easy with Carbonite. For a free 15-day trial plus 2 free months with purchase, go to Carbonite.com and use the offer code EAST. Welcome to East Meets West, episode 219. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Chang. 219.
That's 219 episodes.
It's a lot of episodes since 2005.
We started this way back in the day. Do you remember episode
October
1?
October was the fall of 2005.
Yeah, it was October. I think you're right about that. And I'm trying to find the date here. Oh, yeah. We actually did quite a few on the old blog. I have to go back to the subbrilliant.com/blog. First episode went up October 23rd, 2005. So we're going to have our 5th year anniversary in October. Should we have a big party?
We should have a reunion of everyone involved in the podcast.
Well, let's do. I think that's a great idea.
We can have lunch and cut it short there.
A 5-year reunion of East Meets West. You and I eating a sandwich. We can each get our own sandwich, I think, at this point, now that we've had ads for a while.
Yeah, we no longer have to split a Subway footlong. We can actually, you know, upgrade to like a Togo's or something. Actually, Togo's is pretty gross too. Togo's gives me heartburn.
Sandwich shops are a puzzle to me because none of them are very good. Why can't someone come up with a really, really good sandwich shop? And maybe it's just the, like, wistful romanticizing of my youth, but I can remember Jimmy John's in Champaign, Illinois, having awesome sandwiches. Really good
JJ?
Bread.
JJ? You know JJ?
Jimmy John's.
Sounds like Jimmy Dean. It's like an offshoot relative.
Yeah.
Instead of doing the sausage, he did the cold cuts.
But they used to give their bread out for free at the end of the night, before they closed. You could just go over and get a free loaf of bread, any of the bread that they hadn't used that day. I lived across the street from one, so I do that all the time.
And that's how Merritt Bakery got its start.
Yes.
I think I understand that the whole process of running a sandwich shop is very much a margins kind of thing. So you kind of carve out the profit where you can, which means, you know, instead of real turkey meat, you use pressed meat. Instead of fresh produce, you use something approaching a produce looking a vegetable or fruits.
I do have to say that Lee's Deli in downtown San Francisco makes a pretty mean egg salad sandwich. And I mean that.
Yeah, but everything else there was pretty bland.
Yeah,
I don't remember lettuce being translucent, like pale translucent. And the tomatoes were pretty bland as well. In fact, the only thing I used to get there was the really kind of overcooked Chinese food that they had. And even then, it wasn't so hot.
I used the salad bar there mostly.
Well, they do have like 4 or 5 different locations, so it could just be that one.
Yeah,
the one across the art school. University of Art, San Francisco.
Oh yeah, see, I used to go to the one that was up the street from CNET by 24 Hour Fitness. You all in the audience, you know what we're talking about, right? But back to something maybe more widely applicable. Sandwich shops, good sandwich shops, very hard to find. I kind of said there are no good sandwich shops, and I take that back. There are. I've had them, but it seems like most of them are just crap. And so you think it's mostly because they cheap out on the ingredients, huh?
They cheap out on the ingredients, and most people who are willing to invest the hours in running a sandwich shop probably aren't the same kind of people who are really kind of conscientious about ensuring that the best is served up. And it's probably because they consider it a business, and they consider it kind of a venture to make money, unless, you know, hey, I want to make really awesome sandwiches that everyone knows me for.
I want to be that guy. Well, you know, Tom Colicchio, the chef, he's one of the regular judges on Top Chef on the Bravo Network. Yeah. He has a small chain. Actually, I think I only know of two location, so it may not even be a chain. But he started a restaurant called Witchcraft. Get it? It's a sandwich shop.
Yeah,
gourmet sandwich shop. Ate there once. There's and the one sandwich downtown. Was good. Have you eaten there?
Yeah. That's all right.
It was good, but I was like, it's just good. This is what a sandwich should taste like instead of the crappy sandwiches I'm used to. But I was like, for Tom Colicchio, for the over the top, I expected a sandwich to just blow me away. And
there was,
I couldn't find anything wrong with it. Just, you know, didn't rock.
I don't know. I thought that place was kind of overpriced for what they gave you. Actually, I think most places around heavily trafficked tourist areas tend to be overpriced. But back when I was going to JC, there was a sandwich shop called The Sandwich Shop. And they used to make this really awesome mushroom and roast beef sandwich, really big. And they would take like fresh cut slices of roast beef and they would, you know, do the deli thing, but they would stack it like super high and it was super cheap. It was like under $5. It was like four something, you know, and then you get a soda, a bag of chips.
Value.
But it was not only value, but it was tasty.
Uh-huh. You know, tasty value, even better.
The one thing I will not stand in a sandwich that I have to pay for, like, you know, a sandwich shop, sandwich is cold cuts that are made from pressed meat. It's just disgusting. It's gross.
Well, what is pressed meat? Pressed meat is the discards, right? When they're making other cuts, and then they just kind of squish it down and process out and render out the fat. But it's still meat.
It is, but it's, you know, it's literally everything after you cut all the cuts and what you're left with, and then you take it and you put it together, and then you get it and you squeeze out the water, and then you slice it.
But what makes the pressed meat so crappy? Because I agree with you, it is totally crappy. But
I think it's because it's mostly
sausage is pretty much the same thing as a pressed meat luncheon meat. But sausage tastes awesome.
Some sausage tastes awesome. Other sausage tastes kind of gross.
Yeah,
it's totally dependent on who and where you get it from. You know, patty. You know, some sausages are incredibly, you know, tasty, and the ones just are like, yeah, you know, this is, you know, enough to tide me over until I get some real food. But I don't know. There's this kind of back and forth. There's one side that's literally there to make money, and they're trying to cut as much overhead as possible and you know, provide what is acceptable but not necessarily stellar. And on the other hand, you have people who just like, I want to run a little store or sandwich shop, whatever, and make food that people like, that tastes good, and people, you know, won't talk, you know, walk away saying that's the worst sandwich I've ever had. You know, it goes back to that conversation we had. You know, it's one thing to pay a lot for good food, but it's another thing to pay a lot for bad food, because if you pay like, say, $40 a plate for a steak or something, and it's the most amazing steak you had, it's like, hey, you know what? It's worth $40. If you pay even like $30 for really bad steak, you walk away, it's like, I just paid $30 for a really crappy steak.
What if you paid $30 and you had amazing service in a beautiful location, and everything else about the restaurant was awesome, but the steak was just kind of crappy? You still feel, is it most important to have the food be good? Or
in that case, it better be I would have to say, and this is very unpolitically correct of me, it would have to be a topless bar in that case. Because then I expect just crappy food and drink. But the entertainment should be.
Well, but then your steak's free or like $5, though, because they expect you to spend it all on drinks and tips.
You mean dollars? Dollar bills?
Yeah, dollar bill, y'all.
I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, I've always wondered about those dinner theater thingies, like the one they have over off Mission Bay in San Francisco.
Teatro Zinzani.
If it's worth, like, doing. Like, I've seen, you know, people go there and talk about it, but I don't know. Is it worth the experience? Is it worth paying? How much is it, our tickets? Because you have to pay for the... You pay for the, I guess the dinner and the show is inclusive, because you kind of retard if it wasn't.
Well, hey, here's a question then, I guess, to put it this way. Which would you rather have? A really, and let's say it's the same price, okay? Maybe it's expensive. I don't know. That part doesn't matter so much. But which would you rather have? Amazing service in an awesome location and a really cool, you know, structure with neat things to look at and fabulous entertainment, maybe. And their food's kind of crappy. It's palatable, but it's just kind of crappy. Or a really bad restaurant that's ugly and dirty with awful service, but the food is amazing. Which one would you pick?
The latter. The latter.
Which one's latter?
You know why? The latter is the crappy decor, horrible service, and filthy surroundings, but delicious food, versus the really, you know, palatable food and gorgeous surroundings and amazing service. Because I am of the belief that a very a bad meal can affect your whole day. Like if you eat something that's not the best and maybe starts acting up on you, that totally screws up your whole day. However, if you're only in a place for like, say 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and the food's good, sits well with you, and you feel great when you leave, the rest of the day is awesome. Because, once you eat something, until it comes out or you burn it off, it's going to be in you.
Well, a rude server can also ruin your whole day, but I guess it doesn't stay with you physically. It only stays
unless
with
you're
mentally.
Unless you're one of those people that can't let things go.
Right. Exactly. But it won't land you in the hospital, most likely, unless you punch the server, I suppose, and they punch back.
Yeah. If you get some sort of, and this is what most people worry about when they travel, especially overseas or internationally, is getting foodborne illnesses. And where you're like, I've had friends who go on like one of those all-inclusive resort things, and they're there for like 2 weeks, and except four days are spent laid up in bed because they got some bug or something, and they're just staying in the hotel room. Mm-hmm. It just kind of messes things up. It destroys the whole tempo.
I think I agree with you. I think the food is more important. I set up sort of a false choice there, because there are certainly situations where the food can be really good, but it's not worth it because maybe the service is hostile, or the place just looks unsanitary, and you're afraid of getting poisoned even from the good food. But most of the time, good food will forgive all. But most restaurants are kind of in the middle. Most restaurants are like, the food's okay. It's good enough. And the service is okay. And so it's hard to differentiate.
Yeah, I had pretty gross pasta in San Diego. I was really disappointed, especially when it costs so much. This goes just like, I spent like 20 something bucks. And it's like, this is the worst food I've ever had.
I had a chirashi plate here in San Rafael the other day that was really expensive. And it was good. I enjoyed it, but I was like, really? I don't know if that was worth $29. They gave me tamago, which is the egg.
Ugh.
It's like, really? For $29, you gave me tamago? That's kind of cheaping out.
Definitely cheaping out. So another thing we actually could talk about is
our sponsor. You read my mind. This podcast is brought to you by Carbonite. We all know unexpected computer disasters happen all the time. They could be happening right now. We almost had one happen right before the show. And
I had one the other night.
Did you? What was your computer disaster?
Yes. I got a Trojan through a website. It was very irritating. It took me all day yesterday to clean it out. Ugh. But thankfully, all my data was backed up on a external hard drive that sits over on my shelf.
Actually, see, that's the key, right? Having your files backed up. And I suggest redundant backup. I actually have it backed up on a local hard drive, as well as using Carbonite to back up my files from my Mac. You can use it on a PC as well. And when that computer disaster happens, if you're backed up, you can get your photos, your music, and everything back. The nice advantage to having an online backup like Carbonite is it does it automatically. Whenever you're connected to the internet, it just goes and silently mirrors, really, everything in the background to your account. And you can get it from other locations. They have apps for like the BlackBerry and the iPhone that are absolutely free that allow you to access the files from other computers. So it kind of throws in a little nice extra. You can do that, set that up yourself with a locally attached storage, but it's not as easy as this. So and it's pretty cheap, $55 a year. That's pretty good. So why don't you head on over to carbonite.com, enter the offer code EAST, and you'll get a free 15-day trial. Try it out. If you like it, you'll get 2 free months when you purchase the year by entering the offer code EAST. That's at carbonite.com. So I'm sorry, you were probably not going to say it was time for the sponsor. What were you going to bring up?
Carbonite. Actually, I was. Scott Pilgrim. Scott Pilgrim versus. We both saw that the other night.
I did. We didn't see it together, sadly, so we couldn't share our opinions until now. I absolutely adored that movie. I stopped
you
short
did?
Of saying it was the best movie I've seen all year, because it's not. I think Inception may be the best movie I saw all year, but it was the most fun movie I saw all year. Even with its silly, light moments that didn't make any sense. You know, the plot
I think
is very
loose.
That was
loose. Most of the moments.
Yeah, well, yeah. I still love the hell out of it, because it was just full of, like, really fun and clever and geeky allusions to video games, and it was like watching a comic book, which is what it is, right? It's based on the comic book. What did you think?
I liked it. I wasn't as enthusiastic about it, I think, as you were. Partially is because I'm tired of seeing Mike Cera, in like
Scott.
Every other movie that involves nerds or geeks. I don't know. It had all these things that encompasses like video game nerd culture, and it was fun to watch. But at the same time, it just felt kind of, you know, it didn't feel very filling. Like when I went away, it's like, yeah, it's a fun movie. I probably won't need to watch it again. There are moments where it's like, wow, that's brilliant. And other parts, it's like, yeah, it kind of figures, you know. It's interesting because before I watched it, I read a few of the reviews, and pretty much all of them kind of referred to it as, you know, a movie for male geeks and a movie for video game nerds. But they also used the term Twilight for guys. And I thought it was really useful until I watched the movie, and now I understand why. Essentially, you have a very sympathetic character that everyone can kind of identify with, which is Mike Scott Pilgrim, involved in very kind of you know atypical or just typical situations that people would find themselves in, say, in their early 20s, mid 20s, and then he is chasing after essentially what is this unattainable love interest that pretty much falls and fits all these really cleanly defined areas. She's kind of emo-ish. No, she's just like super cool, at the same time. And it's weird because, it all works out at the end. And I was like, yeah, it kind of figures. It's fun. It's interesting because, coming away from a movie like Kick-Ass, which is another comic book based movie that was just released, I think 3-4 months ago, I came away with a different feeling. I think it's because I enjoyed, the fact that it wasn't the key character that you latched onto, but rather one of the supporting characters in Kick-Ass, which is Chloe Moretz's character, Hit Girl, as opposed to Scott Pilgrim. I couldn't really kind of identify with any of them. Scott Pilgrim's kind of an ass.
Liked the fact that he was an ass, because this was not a typical Michael Cera vehicle where he's like, yeah, oh, the really innocent good guy. Like, he has a little bit of jerkiness to him. He's not 100% of a jerk, but, it gives it a little edge. It's a more interesting story.
I don't know. It felt like it was missing in a few areas. One, not really explaining the doorway. I mean, that was just kind of dropped in. There's a doorway in your head, that just happens to intersect your mind that I skate through to cut time. So I don't want to give away too much to the movie if you haven't seen it.
We already gave away the ending, so you might as well. But no. No spoilers.
I didn't give away the ending. I mean, it's kind of what you expect. I mean, if you watch it in the beginning, it's like, yeah, I kind of figure out it's going to end, and it does.
All right. So, but anyway, you're saying one is the doorway. But I just took that as just like sort of unimportant little side note. I mean, you're dealing with a movie where everyone acts perfectly normal until it's time for Scott Pilgrim to fight one of the seven evil exes, and then suddenly everybody has superpowers.
Video game powers.
Yeah.
So
there's a doorway, whatever, yeah. Like, that's not even important. It's just a fun little aside.
I think also because of, I don't want to say anything because I'm going to give away the ending. Dang it. But it's kind of how the ending ends that kind of bothered me a little bit. So,
see, I liked the ending, and I don't want to give anything away to it either. But I thought, even though it may not be as unpredictable as you're saying you wish it had been, it definitely was different than I expected. It was done in a more believable way. You may think from our conversation that you know how it ends, and in fact, you may be wrong.
In fact, you probably are wrong. But I don't know. I don't know, something about that movie, it felt like it was missing something. I can't put my finger on it. I really enjoyed it. It felt like it was just, you know, you had essentially a plot that tied into all the action sequences, which is, you know, what a lot of these movies do. But it didn't, you know, everyone's so, you know, so glowing in their appreciation for this movie, and I don't see that same thing. I think it was a fun movie. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. But it wasn't something I went away with this like, yeah, you know, that's going to be at the top of my 2010 movie list. Not even like, you know, the top 10 list.
I wouldn't say, so, I wouldn't say it was the best one I've seen all year, but it was I think it might be in my top 5, easily in my top 10. So I differ with you there. I had a lot of fun with it.
Hmm. Interesting. Very interesting. Mm. No, it's just kind of the relationship stuff seemed kind of odd. Well, not odd to me. It seemed kind of, I don't know. You know, on one hand, there was some morality. There was a kind of a morality, you know, play and the, you know, kind of around the relationship issue. At the same time, it seemed to kind of dovetail and kind of, you know, neatly skirt around that at the end, if you know what I'm saying.
Yes, exactly. And it also, it didn't do very well in the box office. It only made $10.5 million, I think, and it was number 5.
I don't think it was widely pushed.
I saw advertisements for it all over the place. I saw trailers for it before other movies.
But I mean, just mean like, you know, if you're not sitting in a movie theater, you know, or do you see, you know, like I didn't see it, it's plastered all over the place or on TV or I don't know. It's just, it seems like one of those movies that appeals to a very small cross section of the movie going audience. I mean, it's like, for example, do you have the box office numbers right now in front of you?
For what? Just for Scott Pilgrim, 10.5 mil.
I'm wondering how the Expendables did.
Oh, Expendables was number 1, I think, and I don't know what it's
serious money in the marketing of that movie.
See, I saw more. Well, I mean, maybe it's because I'm in the target, right? But I saw more ads for Scott Pilgrim than the Expendables.
Mm. No, I saw more Expendable stuff.
I believe you. It was not hitting the places where I watch.
But
Eileen's texted me an article here, which is why I'm being a little silent. Michael Cera this article says, "What went wrong with Scott Pilgrim?" In 2010, Michael Cera hurts you at the box office, and Expendables got 35 million, took away the key audience. So they put it out at the wrong time, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. I don't know. They could always try re-releasing it for the fall. Right against Tron, see how well that does.
Yeah, re-releases rarely seem to work.
No. I predict it's on Blu-ray in 3 months.
Probably 3 months, really. I think it's going to be one of those things that's maybe not, I don't know if it'll be a cult classic, but it'll be a hit later on. It won't do as well. It had a badly timed release.
It'll be a hit later on in home video rentals and late night TV.
Yeah. What is this? The 1980s home video rentals and late night TV. It's going to be a hit on like BitTorrent, I think would be more fair.
I just said torrent.
All right, fine. It'll be a hit on iTunes downloads.
I don't know. It's a fun movie. I'll say that. And even with Michael Cera in it, I still enjoyed it.
Yeah. All right, let's read some of the comments from last week's show with Patrick Beja. Most of them had to do with our continuing coverage of homeschooling.
Wow.
Guys, it seems everyone thinks because someone is homeschooled, it means they never, ever leave home. I would say, based on my experience, homeschooled kids get out far more often to visit real places, zoos, museums, and such. They are homeschoolers, not shut-ins. Patrick seemed to imply this, in my opinion, says Russ960.
Well, you do kind of have to homeschool shut-ins if they won't come out. So there might be a cross crossing.
Yeah. I think Russ makes a good point. I know you're kidding. Russ makes a good point in that, you know, homeschool folks definitely have more opportunity to get out and probably need to get out more because you're not collecting a ton of people in one location, and then it's difficult to move them around in buses and everything. But I don't know if Patrick meant to imply that.
It's interesting. I mean, you know, if you know people who've never had firsthand experience with, like, I only know people who've been homeschooled and know them as friends, but you know, I don't think people can really conceptualize what it means unless they've actually been involved in it. And like we've said earlier, you know, homeschooling, like any form of education, is really dependent on a variety of circumstances. You just can't say, you know, that this methodology is totally you know, irrelevant or you know, not up to snuff because of this one example. You know, it's like saying, well, you know, this treatment didn't work on this one, you know, on this person, so we should never use it again. It's like, you know, it different strokes for different folks. You know, if it works for some people, it doesn't work for other people. You have to match, you know, what works depending on the person.
And then we got an interesting post from Dins, who said, I was reading some reviews of TNT and other Twitch shows on iTunes, and I noticed that some people really dislike the long-form conversational ad format that Twit does. I'd like to get your perspective on this, because Roger works at Revision 3, where the ads are shorter and more TV commercial, whereas Tom works at Twit, where the commercials are these long-form ones. Personally, I've never skipped through a Twit ad and always skip through the Revision 3 ones, because long-form ads are so much more entertaining. Case in point, NSFW's Back That Ass Up. I assume that must have been a Carbonite ad.
One can only hope.
You know, this is interesting to me because I do the ads for Twit and I do ads for Revision 3 because I do Tom's Top 5 on Revision 3. And to me, they're almost exactly the same.
Yeah.
The only difference is on Twit, you see me talking about it with a lower third. On Revision 3, they put up something on the screen that covers your face and kind of demonstrates the product, so it comes off as more TV. But they're both encouraging ad-libbing the ads, and that I think is a temporary situation. But I could be wrong based on the internet being sort of in this new form where the agencies haven't caught up to figuring out how to sell to it. There's not like a decades-old standard like there is in television, radio, and so. They just like they did when television launched in the 40s, and they tried like, oh, let's get the spokespeople to do the ads for us. Eventually, they're going to want to take back control of how that ad is delivered. And you know, I think you're going to see pre-recorded ads everywhere again.
I think the internet provides an entirely, you know, not open, but at least a lot more flexible, you know, way to do things. And, you know, there are a variety of models. There are models that are based on traditional, you know, broadcast that's dropping an ad every, you know, 15 minutes into a show to plug a sponsor. Or it could be the talk radio kind of format, which Twit follows, is you interrupt the programming to bring in the sponsor and you talk about them. In other cases, you can do, you know, what you're alluding to, like back when TV first started, you had the show sponsored by a particular product, like, hey, you know, this episode of East Meets West is sponsored by Alpo. And then, you know, we have your dog, you know, in there in the
Django
bag of Alpo.
Django comes in and it's like,
I think
coughing
all three
up
of
the
those
Alpo
will exist. I don't think you'll necessarily kind of stay on one standard. You know, ad agencies, you know, especially when they deal with the internet, have a lot more money, but they also don't have to spend as much per outlets or per show. So what they'll do is they'll kind of do a shotgun thing where they'll do like five or six. You know, like, we'll try it with this. This show seems to do well with pets. You know, so why don't we have them, like, you know, they'll race for the bowl of Alpo at the end of the line. Whatever dog wins is, you know, the Alpo dog of the day.
Well, and I think the other thing that drove those kind of ads away from most television, I mean, you rarely see them, is the fact that people realized, well, wait a minute. Yes, certain hosts may deliver a really compelling ad and cause a response, but some won't. And why would we want to not reach the audience just because the host isn't good at delivering an ad? If he makes a, you know, we've got an audience there who loves a show and they're waiting to hear from us. Let's come up with something that will reach them. So you may be right. We may kind of end up in a more amorphous situation. But in TV, that mentality took over of like, we want to control the message. And, you know, we want a better spokesperson than Tom and Roger. So we're going to, you know, we're going to put an ad that has, I don't know, LeVar Burton, you know, reading a recommendation of sandwich shops or something, and we know that that people will respond to that more.
You know, they may or may not. It depends. You know, one thing that what cable television did for broadcast television was not only provide a competitor but also offered literally a 3 times increase in the number of channels or shows that advertisers could spend money into. For example, ESPN. What a better way to kind of flog a beer, a beverage, sports beverage, or anything sports related on the sports network. Same thing with the Food Network. You know, we'll do things that aren't maybe necessarily all food, but definitely hitting that demographic of people who are health conscious. So we'll do health targeted ads into that particular demographic. I think what happens is people find something that works with one particular show or style of shows very well, and they'll go with it. And, it may not work with another type of show, and they'll try a different format for that. So you might very well see a kind of a hybrid between, print, online, radio, and broadcast TV style, advertising all kind of mixing in. In some cases, they might, try to do all 3 or 4.
Yeah.
They'll start off the show with a simple, like what we do is a simple billboard. This show is sponsored by. And then, as they go in, they'll do maybe kind of a talk radio style read. And then maybe toward the end, they'll do one more that's a little more in your face television style. And then at the end, they'll might, do something like, hey, sign up for blah, 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 and get your free gift.
It's all gonna hinge on what makes the audience respond. If you and I talking about Carbonite makes you go out and use the offer code East, then
use the offer code East, please.
Then they'll keep. I'm really not trying to flog it again, but then people will continue to want to advertise. If they don't, they'll say, "Oh, we're not getting the response, and we don't want to do that." I think you're right. Whatever form brings that, that's the form where that's going to work. Well, that wraps it up for us. Thanks, everybody, for watching. Thank you, Roger, once again, for being on 219 shows with me, roughly speaking.
Well, would there be a show without me? And don't say there would be, because I hunt you down. I know where you live.
Not for long. No, not for long. And thank you guys for watching or listening. Thanks to Jammer B for running the board. Thanks to Leo for letting us stream live every Sunday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for watching. Bye.